This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
A new interview with the hero of the Texas shooting, Stephen Williford, surfaces. We go there now on Tactics.
My brakes are on fire.
Good morning, everybody.
I'm trying to slow down. I'm always burning my tires.
Welcome to Tactics. It is great to be with each and every one of you on this Monday morning. I noticed that something was going on with our weather. We didn't get that weather report to you. Don't worry, we'll try to get that to you in just a second. But right now, it's just looking like rain. So that's the Tactics weather report for you this morning, I guess. It's looking pretty rainy. Welcome to November in Alabama. That's just the way it kind of always is. But that's where we are right now. That's where we stand. It's great to be with each and every one of you. So one of my good friends and colleagues, I shouldn't call him a good friend. I mean, we've talked maybe once or twice, but a colleague of mine, a fellow conservative commentator, was able to drum up an interview with the hero of the Texas shooting named Stephen Williford. We talked about him yesterday and everything that happened, and he kind of went down the line and talked about the events that unfolded from his perspective, which was really interesting. I got to see the interview yesterday right after the show, and it was really, I would encourage you to watch the whole thing. It's about 30 minutes long, but it's well worth the watch. It was posted on Facebook and Twitter. If you happen to follow us on Twitter at Tactics Radio, or if you follow our Facebook page, you can go to facebook.com/Tactics Radio. It'll be a couple of things down, but I posted that just the other day. So if you are at all interested in seeing it, you can definitely do that. You can look it up at Tactics Radio on all of the mediums that we're on. You can find the full interview if you're interested in it. This guy is an NRA instructor. He started to teach all his kids. He has, I believe, three kids. He started to teach all of his kids to shoot when they were 8 years old. So when they turned eight, he started them on training how to shoot. So this is a guy who knows his way around a gun. He has been a gun safety instructor for the NRA. And just a little bit of background for him. This guy is just a regular guy. He's lived in this little town of Sutherland Springs where the shooting took place. He's lived there his entire life, and he lives a block away from the church. The church that was shot at, he says he's about a block away. It's kind of on the opposite side of the block, facing the other direction, but he was there, and his daughter was there with him on that Sunday when she heard the gunshots coming out, and that's when she told him something was going on. And that's not actually the church that he attends. He attends a different church, but he knows a lot of people at that church. It's a small community, and he has worked with that church in the past. In fact, he was growing at the time what he refers to as his Santa beard, and he does this every year. He starts growing a beard because he works with the church that was shot, the First Baptist Church there in Sutherland Springs. And he dresses as Santa with them because they go around to the different kids in the county, in Wilson County, and hand out presents to needy kids. So this guy, he's just a regular guy, and it sounds like he's a really good guy, wants to go out, help kids. He does this every year with this church. He works with these people. He knows these people. And that was part of the reason he was in such a hurry. This guy also grew up on a dairy farm and was a foreman on a construction site. So this is just a regular working class blue collar American. And he said that he ran out with no shoes on. When he heard the gunfire, he actually ran out of the house without any shoes on. And people were asking him in different interviews, well, why did he run out without any shoes on? He says, because I didn't have any shoes on. And he thought about putting on some shoes or some boots or whatever, but he said every time he could hear a gunshot, he knew what that meant was that somebody that he knew, that represented a person that he knew. And so he didn't even have a magazine fully loaded yet. He grabbed his rifle and he only grabbed just a handful of ammo. He didn't count them, started putting them in the magazine, and loaded up and took off. He didn't have time to count out 30 or however many his magazine holds. I don't know how many his magazine holds, but he didn't have time to count out the exact right amount. He just threw some bullets in his firearm and got everything out of his gun safe and took off. And that's all he had time to do. Didn't even bother putting shoes on when he ran across the way, across the block, through his neighbor's yard and into the church parking lot. Thankfully, this guy was ready when he was. And I wanted to, before we go to the break, I wanted to play you a clip, and it's a little bit long, but I think it's well worth the time, him describing the actual gunfight that took place between him and this individual. Take a listen.
I don't know that I had tunnel vision or what the deal was, but I saw the shooter come from around the front of the vehicle.
Okay.
And at this time, he had a handgun in his hand. And I didn't know, but my daughter said that he had had an AR-15, but when I saw him, he had a handgun.
Okay.
And he had a tactical helmet on, like a SWAT team would use, with a black visor. And he had Kevlar vest, and you could tell it was a bulletproof vest. He had that on. And you know, I'm a Christian.
Sure.
And I believe at that point, and maybe this sounds a little off, just some of their viewers that aren't Christians, I believe the Holy Spirit was on me because I had the presence of mind to look at what was going on. And as we exchanged fire, I noticed that the side was one of those tactical vests that Velcros across, meaning he has Kevlar in the front, Kevlar in the back, nothing in the side.
How far away was he at this point, for context, would you say?
20 yards.
Okay, so 20 yards, so you can see that clearly, and someone like you is trained with firearms, you know, 20 yards is well within what you would practice with.
I had an AR-15 with an EOTech on it.
Sure.
And I trained at 20 yards. That's no real great, amazing shot. I shot between the two Kevlar plates.
Well, that is a great shot with the not to just heap praise, because I know everyone else will, but to have that frame of mind and, like you said, that foresight. I know people are going to be asking, did this come with your NRA instructor training, military background? Because most people would not think to look for this, to be aware of your surroundings. It is remarkable.
Well, that's what I'm telling you. I can't explain the clarity of mind that I had. I can't explain it. And not only that, but I was using the neighbor's Dodge pickup truck. He had a four-wheel drive Dodge pickup truck in his driveway, and I was using it. All he had for a shot for me is my head, because I was behind the truck and using it for cover.
Okay.
And we exchanged fire, and he hit the neighbor's car's windshield. He hit the neighbor's house. And he got into the vehicle, and I fired again. And he fired two more shots through his side. Well, actually, he fired two shots through his side window first. And I noticed the two distinct pistol shots coming through the sides of the window. And I fired my AR-15 again, and it took the window down. It fell.
Okay.
And I took another shot. And at this point, I'm shooting where his head would be.
All right. So this is the exchange that happens. Of course, what happens after that, I didn't play the entirety of, because it gets a little lengthy. But right after that, he jumps into a pickup truck with a guy named Johnny, who was sitting there, who watched this, and they gave chase, went down the highway there at about 95 miles an hour until this guy eventually runs into a ditch. And but that's the gunfire exchange that took place between this guy and the killer that wound up murdering 26 people in the church that morning. It is absolutely remarkable to me that he could pick up on the fact that with the Kevlar vest, that it was one that had protection in the front and the back, but not on the sides. I mean, that is absolutely incredible to me, because as somebody who actually has training with guns myself, I don't know that I would have had the presence of mind to do that. And even with training, I don't know that I would have thought of that in the heat of the moment while I'm exchanging fire with somebody. And so it is amazing to me that he thought about that, and I have to agree with him. The only explanation I can have for the reason that somebody would pick up on that, especially in a pressure situation that was unexpected, it's not like he was in a war zone or something like that. This was something that popped up out of nowhere. The only thing that I can think of that gave him that kind of clarity and allowed him to notice that would have been divine providence, like he said. I think that that's absolutely attributable to the Lord working through him. The fact that I think that the fact that he was there in general was the Lord's work, that he just so happens that an NRA instructor lived nearby and heard the gunshots, and somebody with that level of skill was able to show up at the situation when that took place. By the way, isn't it ironic that an NRA instructor with an AR-15, armed with an AR-15, which most people on the left claim is the most dangerous gun in America, it's also the most common gun in America, the most common rifle at least, stopped this attack? Because we're always told a couple things. First of all, we're always told that the AR-15 is never used for self-defense and it never saves lives, that it's only a killing machine, that they don't use it for hunting, by the way, also not true, and that the only reason anyone would ever own one is because they want to kill people. Well, that's not the case. And the AR-15s are used for self-defense all the time, like in this case. This is proof that the AR-15, because the shooter had an AR-15, but so did this guy. And so AR-15s absolutely are used in self-defense. We've got several different, I could go through the different lines where people use an AR-15 to defend their homes, defend their families. But here we have a very public display, a very, you know, a big news story where an AR-15 was used for self-defense to save other people's lives. We're also told that the NRA is a terrorist organization and they're merchants of death. Does this guy sound like some violent adrenaline junkie to you? I mean, based on everything that we know about him, everything in this interview, he sounds like a down-home guy. He's got, you know, kids, and he's taught them how to shoot, and he's a former construction worker, lived on a dairy farm. This is what a lot of NRA members like myself are like. They're just regular, hardworking Americans. That's all it is. And so for the left to constantly paint NRA members as some kind of scary adrenaline junkie terrorists that they only have guns because it makes them feel good, or because they have a weird gun culture, a weird obsession with death or anything like that, that's simply not true. And this guy proves that. Another thing, too, before we go to the break, this guy, Stephen Williford, was able to end the attack because he had an AR-15 and NRA training, which are the things that would drive a liberal crazy and would say that nobody should ever have. And yet, because of that, he was able to stop this attack. The truth is that most of the NRA members I know are a lot like this guy. They're just regular Americans. And like this guy, I imagine, would say, and like he does say in this interview, it's something that you would hope you never have to do, but if the moment comes, you're really glad that you do have that training and that you do have the proper equipment to take care of a situation like this. Now, mass shootings are incredibly rare, and the odds of any of us ever having to take on someone who's participating in a mass shooting is incredibly limited. But wouldn't you like to have that training, and wouldn't you like to have a guy like this that does have the training and does have the equipment living nearby you in case something terrible like that happens? Because I got to tell you, I'd feel really safe at night knowing that this guy was my next door neighbor. And I bet the people in Sutherland, Texas, all the people that I've talked to have said the exact same thing about him. Nice guy, do anything you ask, anything you would ask him to do, helps out the kids. This is the kind of guy that I would want to live next to. And I'm pretty sure that there are a lot of people in Sutherland Springs, Texas that are glad they live next to him too. We'll be back in a second.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
My hopes of a future life are all founded upon the gospel of Christ. John Quincy Adams.
Welcome back, all. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, let me know what is on your mind. And then, of course, you can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. We do have one more clip from this interview with Stephen Wilford, the guy who was he stopped the shooter in the Sutherland, Texas church shooting. And I really love, I think this was probably the best clip of the entire interview. It's short, but I saved it for last. So let's go ahead and listen to this.
In that sense, the media has been very helpful. And I hope now that I did an interview, that maybe they will, for the most part, leave, go away, at least out from in front of my home, and go focus on what should be focused on, helping the community and however they can.
Right.
You people that grew up in the city or grew up in small towns, you got to understand Sutherland Springs is a small, small town where we walk outside and we see our neighbors, the neighbors that knew our parents and our grandparents, the neighbors that knew us when we grew up, and we say hi. And we stare up, we can still see the stars at night. That's Sutherland Springs. That's where you would always want to be.
You can listen to this guy, and you can hear it in his voice. This guy loves his community. He loves his hometown. So when you ask how somebody is able to do something heroic like this, the way that he is able to rush into severe danger and risk his own life to save the life of other people, this is why. If you want to know how somebody does something like this, this is the reason. Because he loves his home, and most importantly, he loves his neighbors. Which, remember, Jesus said is the second greatest commandment. Second only to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And so because this guy has his faith, because he loves his neighbors, he loves his community, he wanted to help. That's how somebody does something like this. It's no great secret. It's nothing incredibly profound. It's just this guy loves the people in his community, and he loves his home, and he wanted to protect it. That's all it boils down to, and it's all it boils down to for him. You know, I think he sounds a lot like probably many of us in small-town America would also sound. That he just loves the people in his community, and, you know, maybe a lot of us from the smaller towns out surrounding here, like in Wetumpka or Marbury, Slapout, Eclectic, Deetsville, some of these little towns around here that may have people listening, this is what a lot of people love about small-town America. That they can walk out and see their neighbors and look up and see the stars at night, like he said, and know who's there and who's around them, and they spend time with them and they talk to them and they worship with them, whatever it may be. This guy loves his home, and that's why he was able to do this. Americans, what this says is that Americans are still basically good people that will risk their lives to help their neighbors. Why? Because that's what the Bible teaches. And that's what always made us a great country. Not us winning wars, not us being economically prosperous, the fact that we love our neighbors enough to even lay down our lives for them when that takes place, that there are a lot of Americans like that. That's what made us a great country. Take it, Rush.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
Philippians 1:21, for to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, let me know what is on your mind. Be happy to take any calls you have. In regards to everything that we've heard going on, we've heard a lot of calls for gun control, and you're going to continue to hear this probably through the remainder of the week. I've been trying to stay out of the politics of it because you guys know my 48-hour rule. I never comment on the politics of it until at least 2 days after everything has taken place. And even then, I usually only talk about it politically because other people are talking about it politically. And there's a lot of lies out there about gun control. there's a lot of lies about there's two really big ones that are going around right now that we're hearing. First of all, is beyond ridiculous, but the main two are there's too many guns in America, and the NRA is pushing – NRA and the rest of the gun lobby are pushing legislation that Americans don't want. We heard this a lot from Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. We heard it a lot from Barack Obama. Most of the big Democrats use this line all the time, Chuck Schumer, Elizabeth Warren, so on and so forth. But here's – and a lot of them have been saying it the past few days. Here's the thing, though. The NRA and the gun lobby are stopping common-sense gun legislation that Americans want. That's simply not true. Because if you're looking at what the American people want, the last time the majority of Americans favored, for example, a handgun ban was in 1959, when 60% – because Gallup has been asking this question every single year since – very, very early on. I think that 1959 may have been the first year they asked about it. As far as a handgun ban, the last time the majority of Americans favored that was 1959, when 60% said yes, they would favor a handgun ban. Ever since then, it's been under the majority mark. Today, that number is right around 28% in favor. 28%, so that's even less than the Democrat base. Even the hardcore Democrat base doesn't all agree that there should be handguns banned. And there wasn't a question on there for something similar to, you know, rifles, long guns. But if you're talking about semi-automatics, which are usually what are referred to as assault rifles, which, by the way, semi-automatic is most rifles, commercial rifles that are sold today, and most handguns. But talking about banning semi-automatic, just rifles, 48% favor this, but 49% oppose it. So more Americans oppose it than favor it, not by a very wide margin. It's only by 1%. But the point is, the idea that the vast, overwhelming majority of Americans favor this legislation and that evil, nasty gun lobby is the only thing using money keeping this from taking place, that's simply not true. The majority of Americans do not want this. That's not the case. More people favor not having a ban on semi-automatic rifles than the ones that favor it. Again, not by much, but the idea is given that it's completely one-sided and it's just the NRA that's stopping it from going through. But that's not the case. One thing that they'll often cite, too, and this one actually does have, I think, somewhere in, I want to say somewhere in the 90th percentile of approval by Americans, that there should be universal background checks. But the thing is, there are already universal background checks. You go into any federally licensed firearms dealer today, you have to undergo a background check. You can buy it online. Okay, still have to have a background check. I know that. I bought two guns online myself, had to do a background check each time because when I went to pick them up from the federal firearms dealer, they did a background check on me. That's how it works every single time. Universal background checks already happen. And so the only thing, the only stat that they can point to that is actually true, yeah, it is true, and it's already the law. So the idea that the NRA is halting common sense gun legislation that Americans want is simply not the case. Now, this was an interesting one in the same poll by Gallup, because they ask questions about this annually. When asked which party better reflects you on gun control, 44% said Republicans, 38% said Democrats, which means that a lot of those moderates, the people in the middle, the swing votes, they may not be voting Republican all the time, but they overwhelmingly say that by a fairly wide margin, because when you're talking about national polls like this, 6% is a pretty, I mean, that's outside the realm of the statistical realm of error. So the margin of error is actually wide enough that that's not a mistake. 44% say Republicans, 38% say Democrats. So more people, when talking about at least gun control, if you're talking about that one issue, more people associate their views of what gun control ought to look like with the Republicans more so than the Democrats. That was actually surprising to me. I didn't expect that stat when I came across it. So here's the next big question on this. Does the NRA control legislation with money? because I can remember in the campaign, and I, if I were to rummage through my clips archive, I'm sure I could pull it up here, but I am producing the show myself right now, so I probably shouldn't do that on the air. But I can remember Hillary Clinton saying that there are a lot of powerful interests in Washington, but none more so than the gun lobby. They're the most powerful interest in Washington. Well, let's look at that. Let's fact check that. In 2016, they gave barely over $1 million to campaigns and spent $3.6 million in lobbying. So to give you some perspective, because $1 million and $3 million, that's a lot of money. $3.6 million in lobbying, that's a lot of money. That's a lot more than money than I've ever seen in my life. So let's compare that to everybody else and see about how much, if they're really the most powerful force. That means in campaign contributions, the NRA, out of all the organizations that were looked into, because you have to report all this stuff, that places them at 406th in campaign donations. So there's 405 organizations ahead of them when it comes to funding campaigns, but maybe because they spent more on lobbying, maybe they'll fare better in that one. Actually, when it comes to lobbying, they're 155th. So Hillary Clinton can say that they're the most powerful interest in Washington, but there's 154 groups that spent more on lobbying than they did in 2016. And 2016 was actually a big year where they increased their lobbying money, so in the past they've been less than that. In fact, if you're looking at the top 20, which I was doing last night researching, the NRA would have to more than quadruple their lobbying budget just to crack the top 20. Most of the top 20 are things like communication companies, like AT&T. And so the idea that the NRA is the most powerful lobbying force in Washington is frankly laughable. They're not even close. They don't even break the top 100. Is the NRA influential? Absolutely. They have 4 million members. There are people that care about the rating that the NRA gives people on gun control. So there's no question that they're influential. There's no question that they are a big deal when it comes to lobbying. But are they the most powerful, and are they stopping all this pro-common sense gun control regulation that Americans really want? The only reason it hasn't gone through yet is because of all the money that the NRA is just hurling into Washington. I'm sorry, but that's laughably stupid. There's nothing to back that up. It may sound good. It may get you political donors, but it isn't the truth. And so if you're going to be an honest broker about this thing, you have to look at it and say, yeah, sorry, the NRA is not even close to being the top dog in Washington. Sure, they've got some influence, and I'm sure that they have, with some of the education, influenced some votes. But that doesn't mean that they're some kind of secret cloak and dagger organization working in the shadows and secretly halting all gun legislation. But nonetheless, I do want to tell you about somebody that's not shady at all, just like the NRA, that operates out in the open, and that is Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Now, you talk about open and transparent. I remember one of the very first times I went to Woodham's, and I think this was before they were even a sponsor of mine, I had some real trouble with my truck, and I took it in there and wanted them to take a look at it, see exactly what was going on. And they went in, they fixed it, and they brought me out and wanted to show me the work that they had done. Like, they came to me in the waiting room and brought me out there to let them watch them put the finishing touches on it and make sure that they were doing everything right. They asked me to do that. I didn't ask them to do that. And so very open, very transparent. They're proud of their work because they do good work. And that's the thing. When you pay them to do a job, they want to do it right. They want to do it quickly. They want to do it to your satisfaction. And they're proud of their work, so they want to show it off. They want you to get into your car and feel that it's a silky smooth ride, that everything's running the way that it's supposed to. That's how they keep in business. They've been in business for 50 years. You can't do that if you have a lot of dissatisfied customers because word gets around. And so they've been doing this for a really long time because they offer a great service at a great price. Because I got to tell you, I've talked to Kevin about this. Kevin has... He started going to Woodham Southside Firestone a while back, and even he said, man, I've never seen prices like this. I've seen them charge me way more for tires and other things at other places. He says, I couldn't believe that as good as the service was, that I went there and they didn't charge me any more than they did. He said, I think the thing that he was using as a comparison was an oil change. He's like, that was an expensive oil change, and they did it for really cheap, cheaper than a lot of these express lube stations. Yeah, they do. They offer you a great product and great service, and that's how they've stayed in business as long as they have. So even if you need something little like an oil change, maybe you need some new tires, or you need major engine repair, doesn't matter. Go by, see my friends on the Troy Highway at Woodham's Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. All right, the other big lie about gun control, that there are just too many guns in America, and that's what's causing the crime. That and your calls when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals in his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. Benjamin Franklin.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, you can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. But we do have one caller on. You can be on, too. We've got a couple lines open, 860-1440, if you want to fill those lines. But let's go to, right now, John from Millbrook. Good morning.
Good morning. Listen, I wanted to weigh in on this power thing that you're talking about. I mean, the power issue is who has the most influence.
Right.
First of all, I mean, I don't know much about it, but I know the NEA has far more members and far more power. The Teamsters, the United Auto Workers, the American Farm Bureau, all of those have far more power.
Yeah,
but
actually,
those are not hot button issues, and that's, they have way more influence on policy and with the politicians than the NRA does. That's just silly.
Yeah, I was actually looking at all this last night. I was looking, I've got, you know, lots and lots of data. This all comes from opensecrets.org, like I said. And if you're looking at the top 50 political campaign donors, and if you're looking at the top 20 lobbying firms, most of them, well, I wouldn't say most of them, but a large plurality of them are connected to labor unions. And
yeah,
you've got like AFL-CIO, some of the biggest labor unions in the world. Like you said, the teachers union, those are some of the biggest donors. And when it comes to labor unions, the vast majority of them, it's hard to track it in lobbying because you're dealing with issues as opposed to actual candidates. But if you're looking at the campaign donations of the top 50, there were way more going to Democrats than Republicans.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because they're better at utilizing that by far than the Republican side or the conservative side is. They're more independent, but it's all about coalition with the liberal side of it or the Democrat side of it. That's just the way they operate and do policy.
Well, and it has been for a long time. They've always been better at organizing than we were. But it's funny that the Democrats, now their latest big kick because of Citizens United, is that they've got to get the money out of politics when actually they're usually the beneficiaries of big money being in politics more so than the Republicans. Because I was looking at the top 20 donors, and 13 were either mostly Democrat or exclusively Democrat. Only 6 of those were mostly Republican or exclusively Republican out of the top 20.
Republicans are more independent about thought, and they're also not as likely to be grouped together. They're independent-minded business people for the most part, that are the ones that have the power and the influence. And they just don't operate under the same model. And that's one of the things that you have to deal with. And that's true in Alabama, and it's true at the national level as well.
Well, you know, as a general rule, we tend to be more individualistic, and that's kind of why that is the case. And thank you so much for your call. I appreciate those observations. But let's look at the other big lie about gun control, that gun control would stop incidents like this because we just have too many guns in America. All right, 2 years ago, Marco Rubio, during the presidential debates, he claimed that no proposed legislation would have stopped mass shootings over the past decade. The Washington Post, not exactly a conservative news organization, had their fact checker look into it, and they looked at several different mass shootings and shooting events over the past 10 years. They went through each and every one with a fine-tooth comb and found in each case the proposed legislation would not have done anything to stop the shootings, even if they had passed. And so they gave him a rare Geppetto, which means they could not find a single ounce of incorrectness in his statement at all. The simple truth is, when liberals tell us we need to start legislating, this is the time. It's not too soon. We need to go ahead and strike while the iron's hot during the wake of these mass shootings. We need to put gun control legislation on now. None of those things actually would have done anything to help the victims or prevent gun crime in the future. And even the Washington Post admitted that. Also, this shooter at the church shooting did use an AR-15, but so did the civilian that brought him down. That's what he used to take the guy out. And the use of the AR-15 in mass shootings, actually pretty rare. There are mass shootings that do use semi-automatic rifles, but there's only been a couple where an actual AR-15 specifically was used. Now, if you're looking at the FBI and ATF statistics on guns in America, in 1994, we had 6.3 million gun murders per 100,000 and had about 192 million guns in the possession of civilians in America. By 2009, which is the last year that I could find, we dropped to about 3.4 gun murders per 100,000 and had 310 million guns. So ownership of guns shot up by over 50%, and yet we cut the gun murder rate in half. So this idea that more guns equals more gun crime, simply not true. And this isn't necessarily just counting mass shootings. This is counting all gun crime. Gang fights, everything. And it still got cut in half. The only place it's on the rise is in major urban areas. But if you're looking at the country as a whole, the gun homicide rate has been cut in half, even though we've increased the amount of guns that we have to have almost as many guns as we have people, 310 million. But another one that you'll usually hear is, but it works great in countries like Australia and the UK. Well, actually, look at France. They had a mass shooting where 128 people were killed in Paris in a single night. And guns are pretty much completely illegal to buy in France. You can't, there's no, not gun stores. You can't just go and buy a gun in France. And yet somehow all these people got guns, one of which came from Fast and Furious. And I'll not really something to get into now. But if you look at the homicide rates per capita, they had pretty much flatlined in the UK from the year 1980 to 1996. The gun ban in the UK started in 1996 as a result of a mass shooting event, and homicides actually rose dramatically and have been on the rise since, I think, it went from 1996 to 2001, 2002 is the figure that I was looking at with their latest stats. The homicide rate shot up tremendously. And let's look at the Australia gun ban, which was much more recent. Before the gun ban, they had 82 gun homicides per year. After, 58 per year. So people are still killing other people with guns, but it is at a decreased rate. So is that an example of gun control working? Well, not really, because homicides overall went up. The difference is they were using knives. So the homicide rate actually rose in Australia, just less people were killing with guns. People were still killing with guns, just not as many. So it's not about the tool, it's not about the weapon, it's not about the gun, it's not about the knife, it's about the person. It's about the evil people that want to hurt people. These policies don't work because it's not about the tool. It's about the bad guy who wants to do bad things. So when you pass legislation like this, when you ban guns or try to take away guns, all you wind up with is exactly the same problems, but everybody has less freedom. And that's the issue that you're running into. Hour two coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
After Senator Rand Paul was attacked at his Kentucky home, this story really just keeps getting stranger and stranger. We go there now on Tactics. Welcome Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Hour 2 of Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call and weigh in. Real quick, before we do get into that Rand Paul story that I promised you, I wanted to mention a couple things. First of all, in case you hadn't heard, I am going to be out all of next week. I've got another big week of chemo. I'll be out. I'll be in the chair for 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's not what something I'm looking forward to, but it's what I have to do to get better. So I will be out all of next week, but I've got some really great people lined up. Brian Petters, Jody McDade, Becky Gerritsen, and on the show with Becky Gerritsen, which I believe right now is going to take place Thursday if all else works out, we are going to have John Merrill, the Secretary of State for the state of Alabama, on here to talk about the crossover voting law, which is something that I'm really excited about. I had planned to get him on anyway, but Becky suggested it, and since I was going to be out that week anyway, I thought it was a great idea. I know she'll be able to handle that interview. So we'll have John Merrill in studio for that as well. And tomorrow, while I am going to be here, we've got Billy Camp coming in to talk about some things. He's probably going to be co-hosting the week after, so lots to look forward to in my absence. I have you well looked after since I won't be in studio to handle all this, and of course, Joe will be here to help everybody along as well. So we have a lot to look forward to. Now, getting back to this Rand Paul story, this story unfolded in a really weird way because we already reported on the show, I think Monday, that what happened is he had 5 broken ribs and he had lung contusions. But this actually happened on Friday, and it was really not seen as a big news story. It was something that kind of flew under the radar because originally it happened and they reported it, but, you know, he was tackled, but he's fine. And then it grew into he's got some bruised ribs, then it's some broken ribs, then it's he's got busted ribs and lung contusions, and now he's also got reporting that 3 teeth were knocked out. And so this is a weird story in that it keeps getting worse and worse and worse the more we hear about it. I hope that it doesn't get any worse than this. I hope that this is as bad as it's going to get. But Rand Paul apparently having a lot of trouble moving around right now. He's had to he's not going to be able to be back in the Senate for a while, which means he's probably going to miss some key votes, which is really unfortunate because that guy is a conservative warrior through and through, and we really need him in the Senate. But nonetheless, it's tragic that anybody is attacked for their political beliefs, especially in their own home. And I really, really do hate that for, I would say this for any senator that were attacked, that it's wrong to attack somebody like this. But it especially is unfortunate for me because, of course, Rand Paul is one of the few senators in Washington that I actually trust. But now the assailant, the person who attacked him, is saying that it wasn't politically motivated. Now, the FBI already reported that it is. Apparently, this guy is a very outspoken militant Democrat online and has been for a while. But let's just look at his claim first. First of all, he says that this is a long-running dispute about grass clippings that escalated, which I've never actually gotten into a fight with a neighbor over something like that, but it does seem weird to me that this guy would just all of a sudden, if it's a long-running feud, just snap and attack Rand Paul while he's mowing his lawn. I'm not saying that it's absolutely impossible, but that just seems incredibly unlikely to me that this whole thing festered and because Rand is mowing his lawn. And if you look at the houses, they are neighbors in the sense that they live in the same neighborhood, but it's not like their houses are right next to each other. There's actually several houses in between them. And so if this whole thing is about grass clippings, it seems weird that it would have been Rand Paul's neighbor from down the street as opposed to the one next door. And I'm not saying they've never even had a dispute about this before, but it just seems strange that that would be his motive. Now, what do we know about this guy? We know that he absolutely despises Trump, posts a lot of anti-Trump stuff all the time. He has said incredibly nasty things about Republicans. He is a vocal follower of Occupy Democrats. That's a Facebook group. I'm sure that you've seen some of their pictures and some of their stuff. They're an organization there on social media. And he has called Republicans, and this was interesting, the most dangerous group in the world. So according to this guy, the most dangerous people on earth are not ISIS, not the Taliban, not the Ayatollah in Iran, not North Korea, not the Nazis, not the Russians. According to him, Republicans in America, they're the most dangerous group on earth. You can see where this guy is a little unhinged and where he might have been motivated to attack a Republican senator that just happens to live near him. And here's the thing. If this is really a domestic dispute, then it's just fourth degree assault. But if this is politically motivated, then all of a sudden it becomes a federal crime. And so this guy actually does have a vested interest in saying that this is just a domestic dispute between neighbors. And here's my question. If it's just fourth degree assault and that's what he's been charged with, what do you have to do to graduate to third degree? Do you have to actually bust an organ or something? I mean, this sounds pretty bad and is going to put Rand Paul out of work for a while. So why is it just fourth degree? I'm not a legal scholar. I don't know about the laws in Kentucky. I don't claim to. But I don't know. That just seems, it seems like it was a pretty extreme thing. Maybe it was the circumstances surrounding it, or I'm not sure. But either way, just keep in mind that when you're reading about this and deciding for yourself whether or not it's politically motivated or not, keep in mind that this man has a legal vested interest in telling people that this isn't politically motivated, because as long as it's not politically motivated, it's just a domestic dispute and he's facing a lot less in terms of fines and or prison time. If it's a politically motivated attack, then all of a sudden it's a federal crime and then he can be in a lot of trouble. So that's where we are right now. And this is the real takeaway from this. We are living in a really strange time when somebody can just go up and attack a senator while they're at their home mowing their yard. Although I will say this, what does this say about Rand Paul? One thing that I had brought to my attention, and I didn't even think about it when I originally read this story, is Rand Paul is apparently still mowing his own grass. So Rand Paul mows his own yard. I guess he really is a fiscal conservative, because I bet that you could count the number of U.S. senators that are mowing their own yard on one hand. So he's there over the weekends mowing his own lawn. I guess he really is. So when he's talking about tightening up on the budget, it's not just something that he's talking about for America. Apparently that's something that he lives out in his personal life. But, you know, kudos to him for doing that. I hate that this happened to him while he was mowing his yard. Maybe he'll stop mowing his yard after this. I don't know. But really, just pray for Senator Rand Paul and pray for all of our senators that something like this doesn't happen. I mean, as horrible a person as I think, you know, Chuck Schumer or some of the other senators in Washington may be, nonetheless, I don't want something like this to happen to him. The worst thing that could happen is some lunatic that thinks he's on some kind of mission from the GOP attack a Democrat senator in this fashion. And you really hate to see that. So no matter what side you're on, love him or hate him, the people of Kentucky elected this guy. That's who they want in the Capitol representing them and their values. So please pray for Rand Paul's quick recovery. And we certainly hope that he and the Paul family will be able to recover from this. And I don't know what happens after he goes back. Maybe he moves. I'm not sure. Gets a restraining order. Somebody's got to go. I'm not really sure how that works. But either way, please pray for the Paul family and that he'll be back on the Capitol shortly. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
8:10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to call, weigh in, let me know what is on your mind. Don't forget, you can also tweet us at Tactics Radio if you're interested in doing that. We can read those on the air as well. So, because of this Rand Paul story, I thought about this, and I want to take this up to the 10,000 feet level, kind of look at it from a distance and try to draw some connections. What do all of these events have in common? the Republican baseball shooting, the Nazis and Antifa fighting in Charlottesville, New York truck terrorist, the guy who ran down the bike path with the Home Depot truck, the Rand Paul assault, and the Texas church shooting. What do every single one of those events have in common? Well, let's go down the list. At the baseball shooting, that guy was a radical socialist, somebody who had been on Bernie Sanders' campaign, thought that the Republicans had to be stopped. When we're talking about the Nazis and Antifa, both of them believe that it's okay to use violence and intimidation as a form of political speech. In other words, they're perfectly okay with hurting people, breaking property, all that stuff in the name of spreading whatever political ideology they have. When you're talking about the New York truck terrorist, he was a radical Islamist who wanted to kill everyone that didn't subscribe to his specific version of Islam. That's why he had the ISIS flag. That's why he pledged allegiance to ISIS. They believe that they can kill Christians, Jews, anybody that doesn't profess Allah, or even the people that do profess Allah but don't profess it in the way that they deem necessary. So Muslims that aren't quote-unquote Muslim enough. Okay, let's go down the list then. Let's look at what happened with Rand Paul that we were just talking about. His attacker said that the Republicans are the most dangerous group on earth, that they had to be stopped. Then when we look at the Texas church shooter, this guy was a militant and vocal atheist that hated Christians. So what do all those things have in common? Well, they all happened fairly recently, for one. And in each case, there was somebody who believed that they were so right that it was justified for them to invoke violence against somebody else. And at least one person died in each of these events, except for Rand Paul, who was just injured. So, what does that say about us as a country? Because the only mass shooting, big event story like that that we've had that wasn't a factor was Las Vegas. And based on what we can tell from the Las Vegas thing, this guy just really had some mental instability, and at the same time, the only real motive that we can find is that he wanted to be famous. He liked being the high roller. He liked being the person that everybody knew at the casinos, and he wanted to be the best there was at being a mass shooter, apparently. And that's why one of the reasons that they think that contributed to him deciding to murder over 50 people at a concert. So that's the only one that's an outlier. In all these cases, all the ones that we just laid out, the aggressors believe that the other side, quote unquote, is so incredibly evil that they are so right in their beliefs, and the other side is so wrong that they're dangerous and they have to be stopped, and that means that it's okay to hurt or kill them. We're living in a very dangerous time right now. As divided as we are as a country, there are people, and I'm not blaming society. This was a decision made by individuals, and I'm not trying to say that our country as a whole is to blame, but I do want us to think about this. That we now have, on a seemingly pretty regular basis, people that are coming out and hurting other people because they believe that they're justified in doing so, because the other side is that bad. Maybe we can help with this by having civil discussions, by not demonizing each other. You know, I've been guilty of that in the past, too, and I'm doing the best that I can to try to change my tone, try to change my demeanor to kind of help with that. Because shouting down everybody that disagrees with you, if you're like me, if you're a conservative, as being nothing but a communist and somebody who hates the founders, that's not good either. There may be some misunderstandings. There may be some miscommunication. They may actually even be socialists. But you're not going to win over hearts and minds yelling at other people. And that's part of the reason I've been trying to do what I do with this program, which is to try to teach people how to argue, how to debate without getting into the personal attacks. Because I don't think they benefit each other. And I think that maybe because we have so much of that now with living in a soundbite culture where everything, there's no room for nuance. Everything has to be explained in 8 seconds or less, because that's as long as studies have shown we can really pay attention to something, because we're just reading the headlines of articles as opposed to actually reading the articles themselves. And we post and we share only things that we like and that we want. And that means that we live in this little social media bubble where everybody's constantly telling us that we're right, that we're only seeing stories that line up with what we believe, with what we like, with what we comment on. I think doing that has really caused some people, thankfully still a pretty small minority of people that go out and commit acts like this, that's part of what's contributing to people believing that they are justified in hurting one another. So how do we come together? The answer is not easy, but it is simple. We have to really love one another. We have to keep in mind that the person is more important than winning the argument. And winning them over is more important than proving our point. I think we have to start with a simple foundation. The same foundation that our founders came together on. Life, liberty, property. That's what was essentially going to be used in the Declaration of Independence. Of course, that became life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The reason that Jefferson changed that is because he was afraid that people would look to that years later and say, right to property, that means that slaves, we have a right to slavery as well. And so he used pursuit of happiness to give something a little more vague, but really it all stemmed from John Locke, life, liberty, and property. That I, as an individual, even if I disagree with you vehemently, I don't have the right to your life. I don't have the right to take your life away from you. Your life is yours. I have no right and no claim on it. Whether you're an unborn baby or whether you're an adult, you have life, and it's not right for me to infringe upon that. It's not right for me to injure your life, even if it doesn't actually kill you. It's not right for me to assault you, to do any kind of damage. Liberty. It's not right for me to try to restrict you from doing that which you want to do as long as you're not hurting somebody else. I may not like the speech that you're saying. I may not like the fact that you don't believe in God. Doesn't matter. You have the right to do it. I may not like some of the things that you're saying about politicians that I like, about issues that I care about. Doesn't matter. You have the right to say them. The right to free speech, the right to freedom of religion, the right to petition the government, those things have to be absolute as long as they're done within the confines of the law. And I, as another person, don't have the right to say to you, you can't do that. Property. Property is important. Part of the reason that we became the most prosperous nation in the country is that we believe that things really do belong to you. They don't belong to a king. You're not a serf. Your land isn't just on loan to you from the King of England. It's your stuff. It's your land. You have an actual written deed to it. Do you know we were one of the first countries to have written land deeds? And that's part of the reason that we were so different from everybody else economically? Because people actually owned what they owned. And I, as a person, whether I like you or not, whether I like what you do with your property or not, does not give me a right to it. Whether I'm a Christian and you're a gay t-shirt shop owner and I say to you, I want you to print something with Bible verses on it, and you say, no, this is my property, this is my store, you don't have a right to use my facilities to do something against my wishes or against my beliefs, get out of my store. May not like it, doesn't matter, it's your property. So you see how if we can start from that, if we start from that basis of caring about one another enough to respect each other's rights to life, liberty, and property, that's a really good starting point. That if we can explain to each other in a concise way, these are the things that I will never do to you because I respect you as a person too much to infringe on any of these rights, even if we disagree. That's really where we can, I think, start changing some hearts and minds. We have to believe in each other. That people are basically good and that they all do want the right things, because at the end of the day, Americans really do want the same stuff. They want a good education for their kids. They want to feel safe in their own home. And that's true, left or right, doesn't matter. So what we really need to do is find that common ground, find that foundation, and I think maybe not with everybody, but if we can just find a few friends, a few people that disagree with us, that we can agree on that stuff first, then we can start having conversations about more important things. If we can start from that basis, I really do believe that we can make some headway. It's not going to be easy. But if the alternative is living in a country where we don't respect the rights of others, then this is a fight that I think is worth having. This is a discussion that is worth getting over and getting out of our comfort zone in order to have it, if it's what we need to have a unified country. And I think that is absolutely worth it. Do have some interesting things about that on socialism coming up in just a moment.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Whoever is an avowed enemy of God, I scruple not to call him an enemy to his country. John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in and let me know what is on your mind. By the way, I did want to thank everybody, and News Radio 1440 would like to thank everybody for coming out and stopping by our booth at the Alabama National Fair as we helped raise money to support the Kiwanis Club of Montgomery, as they work to really hard to help out local charities around here and our community. So thanks to everybody that was participating in that, went by. I am sorry that I was not personally at the booth myself, but as you can imagine, I can't really stand outdoors for a really long time nowadays, and especially with everything I'm going through with the chemo, I wasn't really able to do that this year. So I do apologize for that. I do wish that I had been able to go there, wish that I had felt up to it, but you know, hopefully next year, and we'll have several events to where you can show up and meet me, hopefully before too long, hopefully when I can kick this cancer thing out, and hopefully that'll be before the end of the year. But anyway, we do appreciate everybody coming out and supporting us with that, for all of you who came by our booth. Also, Sports Radio 740, our sister station, would like to help you win $10,000 from Hardee's. All season long, you have a chance to win big if the Auburn Tigers return the opening kick of either half for a touchdown. You can go to sportsradio740.com and register weekly for your chance to be our weekly winner. It is the Hardee's $10,000 kickoff payoff with Montgomery sports leader, Sports Radio 740. And don't forget that that means tomorrow we do have one of the Sports Radio 740 hosts, Joe Hunt, coming on to hang out with us. So that'll be something fun to look forward to. That's coming up with Upon Further Review. Before we get into all that, though, finishing up today's show with the what's going on right now in the Chaplain's Report, there is some interesting new polling coming out on socialism. Now, Pew Research did this poll. This one's a little bit older than the one I'm about to reference. But they asked people of different parties if they felt positively or negatively about different ideas. When asked about socialism, only 15% of Republicans and 26% of independents were positive, but 44% of Democrats said that they were positive when it came to socialism, while 43% said negative. Now, granted, that is close. It's only a 1% difference. But think about that for a second. One of the major parties in the United States of America, the country that brought down communism, 1% more of that party thinks that socialism is a positive thing compared to the other parties. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not a GOP guy. I'm not a registered Republican. I have not voted for Republicans in the past because I didn't like the candidates that they put up. I consider myself a conservative first, but when you're looking at one of the major parties in this country and the people that were polled there, 44% said socialism is a good thing, that they had positive ideas about it, when even in the independents it was barely over a quarter of people. That says a lot about how far we've come as a country. I think it says something pretty scary about where we are as a country. That they think socialism is just this well-intended but often misused or poorly explained idea. Now, there is some good news in this same poll. 77% across the board in this Pew Research poll had a positive reaction to states' rights. That is encouraging, because used to, states' rights was associated with, well, that's just an excuse for racism. Now, I don't know how that got all played up in there. I guess it has something to do with the Civil War. The reason that when people used to hear states' rights, they'd say, well, that means racism. That's what that is. No, has nothing to do with racism, has nothing to do with slavery. It has to do with the states having sovereign power over the federal government. Now, according to Pew, 77% of people had positive reaction to the word states' rights. I think that Donald Trump being in office has had a lot of liberals thinking, maybe an all-powerful federal government isn't such a great idea. Which, maybe that might be the best thing that's come out of Donald Trump's presidency, because if that's where you are, if you tend to lean left and you're thinking states should have more say over what happens to their money and what happens in our schools and so on and so forth, congratulations. Welcome to the Tea Party. Good to have you here. I'm being serious. I'm not saying that condescendingly. Because if states' rights are something that now 3 out of every 4 Americans sees as a positive thing, then I think that's some really encouraging starting ground. That's something that maybe we can start to come together on. That's something that makes me optimistic. So even though I am deeply troubled by the stats on socialism, the fact that now over 3/4 of America are saying that states' rights is a good thing, maybe that leaves us some wiggle room to start reenacting the 10th Amendment the way it was always intended to. Now, there was another poll taken by the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. They do this annual study every year on what people think of communism and socialism. 34% of Americans, this was amazing to me, would rather live in a socialist nation. 34% would rather live in a socialist nation. Now, 59% said they'd rather live in a capitalist nation. But still, that's getting close to barely being a majority. And to think that 34% of our country thinks that a socialist nation would be a better fit than capitalism, that is terrifying. If you want to hear something even more scary, this same study found that 44% of millennials would prefer to live under socialism, while only 42% said capitalist, 7% said communist. So if you add communist and socialist together, then that means, and I can do math on the fly here, 51% of millennials would rather live in a communist country or a socialist country than they would a capitalist nation. I hate to say that, being a millennial myself, but I gotta say, if that's the case, my generation is full of idiots. Not necessarily idiots, but certainly people that are ignorant of history. You know, I don't understand why communism and socialism are not seen with the same level of disdain as, for example, Nazism. Hitler killed 6 million people in the about 4 years that he was in power. Stalin, during the Great Purge, killed somewhere between 10 and 20 million in 4 years. The body count was huge. Many times that what Hitler did. We still don't even know exactly how many people were killed because it's impossible to get records on that time. And yet somehow, we don't view communism and socialism as a bad thing. Millennials really need to know their history on this because it happens every single time. If you would prefer to live in a socialist or a communist regime, then, and I'm not saying this condescendingly, seriously, do some research on this. Move to Venezuela. Move to Mexico. Heck, move to one of the more peaceful ones. Move to Sweden for a while. See how that works out for you. and really test if that's really what you would prefer to do. Now, that means that 7 of 10 of them, another stat that this found, 7 out of 10 millennials, like all Americans, cannot correctly define what socialism or communism actually means. And that's why I would say I encourage you to do some research, because they're saying, well, we like socialism, we not like communism, but they can't correctly define it. They don't even know what it is. They're supporting something blindly. And this is why I say you've got to be rock solid in your beliefs and you've got to do your own homework, because otherwise you're going to be believing and voting for and advocating for something that you don't even really understand. You have got to do your own research on this stuff. Now, I believe that there are some millennials, at least 3 out of 10 of them, that do understand what it is. And I would say a bunch of them support it because of that, and a bunch of them don't support it because of that. But there is hope in all of this, because in this same study, the generation after the millennials, which is just now emerging, Generation Z, 66% said that America's economic system works for me more than others. And they are the only generation that was pulled by this that got anywhere close to that other than the greatest generation. This is the Tea Party generation. And this is, according to this poll, a group of young people that are stirring up directly after the millennials. So there is hope. And they did not have nearly the warm and fuzzy feelings for socialism that the millennials did either. I think maybe what happened is a lot of people realized that the millennials didn't know anything about socialism and communism, and because of that, we started educating the younger ones. You see, we need education to help these people. Don't be afraid to have discussions with people about history and the flaws of socialism and communism, especially when we're talking about young people, because, quite frankly, they just haven't gotten that education much. You need to know what you believe so that you can pass that knowledge on to others. Because keep in mind, it wasn't just millennials. 7 out of 10 Americans, as a general population, didn't know what socialism and communism really were. So do your own homework, do your own research, know what you believe so that you can pass that on to other people. Chaplin's Report is up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 1:21. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in, but it is time for the Chaplain's Report before we send it off to Rush at the bottom of the hour, at the top of the hour. I think it's clear that based on some of the stories we've covered today, and I've been thinking about this a lot, we have a severe issue with our priorities in this nation. And I'm not trying to just point the fingers at liberals. I'm talking about all of us. We have a severe issue with some of our priorities. So I was thinking about some of the things that maybe I make mistakes on, and sometimes I let slip into the position that God should hold in my life. How do we keep things like politics from becoming an idol that we worship? Because these things are important, and I don't think that it's wrong. In fact, I think a lot of good can come from being active in some of these things. But the question is, how do we get that to the point to where we're not worshiping that or putting it on a pedestal that we shouldn't be? How do we get to the point to where we as individuals are keeping that from happening? Well, there's a couple things I think that the Bible gives us instruction on. First of all, let's go to a warning from 1 John 2:15-17. John writes, "Do not love the world nor the things that are in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For of all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lust, but the one who does the will of God lives forever." The Apostle John is talking about two things primarily here: priorities and perspective. When he's talking about priorities, if we seek the love of the Father,
the love of the world is not going to be in us. We have to pick one. We can't have both. There is no riding any fences when it comes to this. We are either thinking the way that God wants us to, or we're thinking the way that the world wants us to. Now, we can switch back and forth from those because we're people, and sometimes even good Christians that do have spiritual mindsets fall into a worldly mindset from time to time. But the point is, we can't be thinking about both at once. So we've got to make it our goal to consistently, constantly think about things the way God would want us to think about them. Because otherwise, we're all caught up in the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Anything that we love in this world, we must love because of our love of God. Whether that's family, our church, or whether it's ideas like justice and wisdom, whatever it is, we have to want those things and love those things because they're what God wants us to want, not because we want them for ourselves. A great example of this is C.S. Lewis in the last book in the Chronicles of Narnia series, when they all, spoiler alert for a book that's like 60 years old now, when they all die and they go to Aslan's country and they see this description, which is supposed to be symbolic of heaven. They see the professor's old home. They see Cair Paravel, the castle from Narnia, only bigger and better and more restored than they were back in Narnia or back in the real world. And what they realize is, and I believe it's Lucy that makes this observation, she says, "I understand now. The reason that I loved these things before is because they reminded me of their real version, the version that's here in Aslan's country." And see, that's a spiritual mindset, that there are things in this world that we love, but we only love them because they remind us of something heavenly, something spiritual, something that's going to bring us closer to God. So that's the priority part of it. Also, perspective. Why love things that aren't always going to be around? Because some things just aren't going to be around for all that long. Worldly things pass away. That's the nature of a physical world. It decays. That's the way God designed it. So it makes no sense to put our love and our hope in things that aren't going to be around all that long. Wealth, prestige, fame, you can't take those things with you. Eventually you're going to die, and it's going to all be gone. You won't have access to it anymore. You see, if you hitch your wagon to the world, then you're going to share its fate. The wicked become so because they get lost in the world and what the world says. All the attackers that we talked about this morning that hurt other people because they thought that they were right, they got caught up in worldly mindsets. And I talk about politics in a way because I believe that it helps people spiritually. And that's where our priorities should lie. Everything we do in word or deed should be done in the name of the Lord. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.